This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. A rich vein of soapstone, a soft, workable, acid-impervious, and beautiful mineral, lies just below the surface of parts of Nelson, Albemarle, and Amherst counties. A couple of months ago, Charlottesville resident Pete Farley came on The Spark to talk about the joys of growing up around the once-thriving soapstone mining community of Schuyler. During the interview, Pete put out a call for more information about the Albarine Quarry's history. Lenny Sorensen immediately sent me a note saying her son, Carrick Ashmore Sorensen, was the source for all things Albarine and would be glad to give me a tour of what's left of Schuyler and the Albarine soapstone operation. So off I went, over the mountain and through the woods to Route 6 in Nelson County, right on Route 800, and in through the Albarine Gate. And just as Mom had promised, Carrick graciously showed me all around, both the Schuyler that is and the Schuyler that was.
We're standing in the center of Schuyler, 1920 to 1975, actually. The larger of the two buildings there was the post office until 1975 for Schuyler, and then it moved up onto the hill. The little building next to it was the doctor's office, which was used by a visiting doctor, so it wasn't staffed all the time. And then in this open spaces was a restaurant, a laundry, a couple of rooming houses, a auto repair, gas station, all that kind of. This was the center of town. The remaining cottage, which is right around the corner here, I'm told was the house that Earl Hamner's parents lived in when they were first married. When you came down Route 800, you would come down this hill and down this driveway and into this parking area, and then you would go around this mill building and then up the hill. And that was the way it was until 1969 when Camille came through here and wiped out the roads. So then they rebuilt this, and this is the new road up to the top of the hill, which bypasses the plant.
So this was Schuyler.
This was Schuyler.
Okay.
And in the way that many company towns, but certainly this one was really from scratch in a lot of ways. I mean, there was a little bit of a little hamlet here, but in many ways, this was from scratch. So the company, when you come down the hill, there's a lot of little houses that look very similar. Some of them are actually Sears kit homes. The company owned upwards of 120 to 200 homes that they rented.
Coming up, is that the way?
Coming down from 6.
Okay.
Right. And as you drive through the neighborhoods, you'll see more houses that look just like them. And those were all company homes. And they supplied electricity. They had one light bulb and water. That's what they did for all of these places. The building right outside the gate here on the left is the Oddfellows Hall. And it is in one of the earliest pictures I have of this place. So, and then everything that you see built here now was in place by 1905. The company started at Albarine, which is 5 miles to the northeast. In 1883, they got their land patent. By 1987, they were in production. By 1905, this plant was completely built. All the buildings are soapstone, 1.25 inches at a time. Labor was cheap, stone was free.
What do you mean 1.25 inches at a time?
1.25 inches layers. It's all scrap stone. So when you go to Albarine, the buildings over there had stone foundations, but they were wooden buildings because they were in a hurry. Here, they had plenty of scrap, and they just put these buildings up.
The main plant building burned in 1975, but in addition to it is still standing and still operational.
When we get in here, you'll see the scale of this thing and understand how fast this thing was moving, in that that's 60,000 square feet, that building. The walls are 30 feet tall, and they are 18 to 24 inches thick. And that part of that building right there was started in 1911, and it was finished in 1915.
Is there mortar?
A little bit of mortar, yes, but mostly
stack.
Mostly stack. And considering Camille in 69, which dumped 8 feet of water in this parking lot, it reached almost to the second floor. The building's solid. the, you know, we keep having tremors and earthquakes and stuff, and the buildings remain, and which is just a testament to the material and the workmanship. Tower over there is 80 feet, and, you know, 1905.
What's the point of that?
There were three power stations for Schuyler. To the west is powerhouse number one, which is one of the oldest step dams, I think, if not the oldest step dam in Virginia. And it was pure hydro. Then at the crossing of the Rockfish here at Schuyler was a combination coal and hydro. So there's another smokestack over there. And there's pictures that show the fish ladder and you know, I mean, it was a real operation. So they used the dam when there was water, and they burned coal when there wasn't. And then this is powerhouse number three, and it was pure coal. Now, it served two functions. One was it generated electricity, which they then supplied all over the place and ran the plant with it, but it also supplied steam to heat all of the buildings and the process water and everything that kept this place rolling three shifts a day.
There used to be a lot of other buildings around associated with soapstone mining in the town of Schuyler.
The steel building is what is left of the gang saw buildings. There were four buildings like it, one directly across from it to the west here, and then two over here in this thicket. And there's a big foundation, and one of the original quarries was there, and then it was filled in, and then they put that building there. And there were altogether 24 gang saws. And there was a crane that went from that back corner of the original building back there all the way across to the back corner of this quarry over here. It was a 20-ton crane with two bridges, and it serviced the trains coming in and out of here. They did 70,000 square feet of finished material a month went out of here at the high point, which is a phenomenal amount of material. But what's really impressive about that number is that it represents about a 15 to 25% quarry yield, which meant 15 to 20 blocks out of 100 would actually leave the quarry and come to the plant. And then once it was at the plant, they would go through another selection and then go into process. So many of those blocks that came to here were put back on the train, taken back out to the quarry, and on the way or at destination got dumped. So when you drive through the area here and you see these huge piles of stuff, that's what that is. This is all stuff that's, you know, it's traveled. And that is what represents a large portion of what we are now re-mining. It's now economically possible, feasible, and desirable to reuse all of this material. You're getting, with very actually few exceptions, stuff that was mined 120 years ago.
What has changed about mining and...
The gang saws are like a gigantic bread cutter you see at a grocery store. There's 50 blades in there, 30 whatever blades, depending on the size of the saw. They cut using a fairly tremendous amount of force, and when you put a block in there, it has to be as close to perfect as possible. If it falls apart in there, it jams the blade and can just destroy things. So they were really, really picky. Plus, they owned 6,000 acres, they had 2,000 employees, and they took the cream of the cream. And if it was anything wrong with it, they dumped it. If they processed, they had a standing order with American Desk for 50-inch tall by 90-some-inch long slabs. If a corner fell off of it, they dumped it. They didn't reprocess it. They didn't take it and set it over here and we'll cut it later and no. They just put it on the train, dump it, get it out of the... I've got things to do. They had three shifts. They were rocking. You know, I mean, it's just moving right down the road.
How long was the hike?
Well, the original growth curve was amazing. I mean, from, you know, 1887 to 1905, you look at what was built here and the demand was just phenomenal. And it rolled at that level clear up to the Depression. And then the impression is that somehow, oh, well, it closed down. Well, but it didn't really close down, and it was still really a valuable commodity. A lot of the things that they were doing, obviously, fell by the wayside. The more decorative stuff, the more luxury stuff, the, you know, non-utilitarian. But at the end of the day, wash tubs, bathroom dividers, stair treads, I mean, there was just a core selection of product that just, there wasn't really a very good replacement.
For example, Albarine Soapstone talc was used to buffer all the tires shipped out during the two world wars.
And you know, if you go and you buy a tire now, it's got talc, you feel it, it's got talc in it. And it's just that this place was central to the industry at the right time. And until very, 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 very recently, it was the largest operating deposit of soapstone in the world. And in 1986, it was one of only three working deposits of dimensional architectural grade steatite, is the proper term for it, soapstone in the world.
So it has it ever shut down entirely?
Not entirely. It came real close. I mean, when I took over, there were three guys working here.
And when did you take over, Kim?
I took over in 98,
okay.
October of 98. But they were doing school jobs. They were doing, you know, lab work. They were producing material. That's what they always did, and they continued to do that. A quick early history, just to set the stage of how this kind of came to be. Soapstone was already being developed in the Northeast. People are used to hearing soapstone associated with Vermont. The northern band of this band of stone is quite soft. And the subtle difference is almost only a dog can hear it. We are operating at about 95 to 98% talc in our structure. When you get north, you slide towards 100% talc. And so then the term soapstone starts to become really understandable. You start thinking about welder's pencils and seamstress marking pencils. It's semi-translucent. It's totally soft. You can just kind of just dig it with your fingernails. It sticks to your hands. It's soapy, okay? It is not structural. It has a lot of the thermal properties of this stone, but you can't really build with it. And that's Ontario and really northern Vermont as it slides into that whole area. In Vermont, you start getting into what we then consider steatite, and they were using it for buggy warmers, bed warmers, griddles, oven stones, thermals. It was a real thermals thing. If you go to Boston and you dig up the road, you're going to find 4-foot sections of square cut soapstone that's been drilled, and they use it for water pipes. So plumbers had an understanding of this material because they were always putting in sinks, wash tubs, all of these kinds of products were being manufactured there.
So, 100 years ago, not only was soapstone considered a valuable natural resource, but Central Virginia was sitting on the largest deposit of structural soapstone, steatite, in the world. Back after a break with, as Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story. Oh, yes, and Bob Levicky's checked this out in an essay by Turner Ashby Jr., Jennifer Bays. Before the break, we were enjoying a tour of Schuyler, past and present, with sculptor Kirk Ashmore Sorensen, who's currently part owner of Albarine Soapstone Company. Today, downtown Schuyler is almost a ghost town, hovered over by a massive stone wall. At its height, however, back in the first half of the last century, Schuyler was a bustling mining community, processing stone from three different area mines, Albarine, Old Dominion, and Climax. Kirk was also telling us of the many and varied industrial uses for soapstone, including pipes that were much beloved by plumbers.
One gentleman named James Serene was such a plumber. In the Civil War, He, I believe, was a captain. He was at least a Union soldier, but legend is that he's a captain. Comes down through Virginia and sees this deposit and sees what the Indians are doing. And a light bulb goes off in his head. And very quietly, he stores this knowledge away. And the minute that the war was over, he got on a train and came down here. And because what he realized was that this was a larger deposit of a higher grade of material. And in that transition, as important as Vermont, as the Vermont deposit was, as developed as it was, 1887 happened for this company here. By 1905, they had the lock. This was the source, period. They had sales offices in New York, Philadelphia, and Chicago. Each of those were associated with a sub-manufacturing unit. This shop here made all the dimensional panels, and they made tubs, which is why they call this the tub shop. So sinks, aquariums, wash tubs, lab tops, or lab tubs, all of those kinds of things. That's how amazing this deposit was. The original plant sat on 6,000 acres, and they ran soapstone from north of Albarine all the way down into Amherst. You know, as far as like Nelson County, there wasn't anything else here. There was apples and chestnuts and soapstone. That was the economy here. And they started off with chunks. I mean, it didn't all just happen overnight.
But did they have to pay anybody?
They bought, like they started at Albarine. So Albarine, I think, was about, if memory serves, it was about 300 acres. That they laid claim to, and then they had to go through some kind of process to secure the minerals. They call it a patent. So they got their land patent in 83, and after much wrangling and court fights and everything else in 87, it was ratified. It was one of those cases where someone says, oh, wow, this is really cool. And everybody that was standing around for the last 30 years goes, oh, really? Oh, well, then it must be valuable. I'm not selling you my land unless you write me a huge check. And it was like, well, no, we had a deal, or, you know, all that kind of wrangling. And then they slowly built. And then at the same time that Albarine was being established, there's a guy named Mr. Bug over here at Old Dominion who started his soapstone plant because he saw and went, oh, okay. But he didn't have access to the money and the funding, so he didn't have access to the rail lines. So that he started, but very quickly was just purchased.
How about the Native Americans? What were they doing with it?
They were really using what is basically top rock. I mean, things that were right by the surface. But you can look over there and see the back wall of that quarry, and you can see how close to the surface it is, and how this right here, it was all right here. So what they were doing with it was they were making pots. So they were, you know, digging out this. It was all very soft stone, stuff that they could cut with an antler and, you know, gouge in other sharp rocks, which is, you know, sculptors today, we tend to use sharp rocks and things. I used nails the first winter that I started really carving seriously. I was using nails and a claw hammer. And so what they were doing was they were carving out these bowl shapes, and then they would use them, and then they would leave them, because it's 180 pounds a cubic foot, and they weren't schlepping any of this stuff around. And they didn't need to, because they were going from here to there and then back over here, and then they would come back and they would find their old pots, or they'd dig another one or whatever. So as you wander through the area, you find these places where there's these shards, and you can look at it. You know, certainly someone who has the eye knows, oh, well, that's an old thing. So it was pots. It was also cooking stones. They're going to take a nice chunk of something about the size of a grapefruit, and they're going to heat that in a fire, and they're going to drop that into a basket of water, and things are going to boil.
The Albarine Soapstone Company today mainly uses harvested stone, soapstone that had been mined and then abandoned in piles around the county. But all that harvestable stone first had to be taken out of the ground at one of those three mining sites.
So is there quarrying going on in each of those three locations?
No, we don't have that kind of staff. We will, Old Dominion, we actually reopened for quarrying. And I make the distinction between quarrying and harvesting. The majority of what we do is harvesting. Quarrying we got into because of the push for the larger slab sizes and a certain clientele that really requires it. We decided, okay, well, we'll start actually cutting material out of the ground virgin. So we set up there. It's a pulse activity. We'll have two or three guys, four guys over there for a period of time till we build up a stockpile of material, and then we'll pause and process. a lot of it is, you know, market driven. I mean, if there's a large demand, then we're going to be busier. Harvesting is just always nice because it gives us a real wide array of flavors. You know, you get into a quarry, it changes from one side of the quarry to the next, and from one end of the quarry to the next, it really does change, but not the kind of dramatically that we want to be able, that you can recognize in a picture. I mean, the difference between Old Dominion and Climax is striking. It really is different. Albarine is what we primarily use for labs, which we still do. We are specified by the New York City School Construction Authority for laboratory work. And what we do is not so much the tops, which we would like to do, but the tops are from a cost benefit, blah, 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 is that it's all epoxies and resins and plastics and that. But what they cannot replace is the acid containment rooms, where they actually store the chemicals. So when we do those jobs, it's soapstone tiles, soapstone cladding on the wall, soapstone shelving, and a big sink.
Kirk Ashmore Sorensen is first and foremost a sculptor who, back in the day, was studio manager of David Breeden's Biscuit Run Studio. He and I were inside the noisy soapstone processing building when I asked Kirk what his relationship is with today's Albarine Soapstone Company.
I took over in 98 as a full owner. I just bought the place from Tuolei Kiwi. Yes.
Okay.
Someone sidled up to me at a party, at a gallery opening, and said, dude, you know, they're selling the plant. You should get some artists together and go buy it and do something cool down there. And I was like, yeah, right. How do you do that? 2 years later, it happened. But during that 2 years, one of the discoveries I made is that, you know what, if you really, really go after something, you can actually get it done. And you don't need $1 billion in your pocket when you start down the road. So that was really an important thing. But during that whole period, because of that dynamic, I was looking for who wanted to come down here and play. Because I didn't really want to be the industrialist at that level. I wanted to be the artist and the architectural carver and the vet. But I knew that there was a commercial thing here that was exploitable, that needed to be that needed to be saved, right? And that there were jobs here, and that there was an industry to be harnessed, so I was always looking for people to come play with me down at the plant. Never happened. Finally, the opportunity just gelled the way it did that I just bought the place. And it wasn't then until 2004, suddenly there's a bunch of guys, and they're like, oh, yeah, well, this is interesting. Yeah, well, you know, let's do something. We'd like to do something. Okay. So at that point, I took over, basically, I stopped being the guy and became the head of operations. And we really went through a growth thing. That's when we got some new equipment, and we really started to kind of look at this from that industrial point of view. We stopped doing a bunch of things that were fun but not really profitable, and really started pushing out into, you know, materials. And so I was the director of operations during that period of time, working with a general manager and my partners to build the business. So then last year, well, it's been about a year and a half or so, you know, I've kind of gotten itchy feet. I really want to make sculpture. I'm 50 now, and, you know, this is really heavy work. You know, I've done the bad back thing. But, you know, there comes a time when it's just where you just really just can't do it anymore. And I want to have gotten a lot of things done before I reach that place. And in that interim, that's when traditionally all of us got apprentices and taught what we've learned. And I knew that if I continued doing what I was doing, I would not get that opportunity. My partners have been very supportive in all of that. I'm operating out of here. I am the keeper of the history. I am the company memory. So I consult with them about things that they have ideas on and whether or not someone else has tried them and what their results are and, you know, how that thing works and where the stone is and how to do whatever it does. So that's roughly my, you know, I'm an owner, but that's not really who I am. I just happen to be that. I'm really more a consultant and advisor and consigliere.
The 1920s marked the peak of the soapstone boom for Albarine and Schuyler. But demand remained robust well into the 60s. You'll find a lot of pictures taken during my visit to Schuyler on the Spark page at WMRA.org. And Kirk Ashmore Sorensen has put together a beautiful book he calls Albarine Soapstone, A History in Photographs. It features photographs commissioned by the Albarine Soapstone Company in the 1920s for use in their catalogs and sales materials. The photographs were taken by Rufus W. Holsinger, the well-known Charlottesville photographer. You'll find a link through which you can preview Kirk's book and then order it on the Spark page at WMRA.org.